Robert Pinsky says if it looks like a poem, it probably isn't. That it's the ordinary that gives birth to the muse and to poetry. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. My guest today is Robert Pinsky. He is a poet, a critic, and a teacher. He's the author of 4 books of poetry and 2 of criticism. The books of poetry, Sadness and Happiness, An Explanation of America, History of My Heart, and most recently, The Want Bone. His works as a critic include The Situation of Poetry and Poetry and the World. Mr. Pinsky received his B.A. from Rutgers University and his M.A. and Ph.D. from Stanford. It's a pleasure to welcome Robert Pinsky to Conversations.
Hello, Susan. Thank you.
I am most intrigued about what I opened with, that if it looks like poetry, if it looks poetic, that it probably isn't.
Well, when our experience reminds us too much of art, if we say it's just like a movie or it's just like a poem, that's because it's been done. So from the artist's point of view, you have to look to the part of your experience that you see every day and think about a lot, are obsessed by, but tend to dismiss as being not poetic or not important enough or not noble. If a lot of our imagination is at the mall for suburban Americans, middle-class Americans, then there's got to be a poem somewhere in the mall. And it occurs to me that the George Romero zombie movie does get some of the poetry of the mall in a very wonderful scene. I think it's the Day of the Living Dead. If it's Main Street that you see, if it's the store your dad works in or the factory or I don't know what it is for different people, that's your job as an artist, is the thing you see a lot that is not already. Baudelaire didn't make it poetic. Dickens didn't make it poetic. It hasn't already been made into art. You know, Wordsworth has looked at a beautiful lake. Mm-hmm. And
what Baudelaire and Dickens did with the city, for example, then is to see the poetry in it when no one else had seen it.
In the fog, in the bridges, mm-hmm. In images like lights coming on in the evening that now to us are quite poetic. I would assume there's a point in the history of cities before Dickens saw it or Baudelaire saw it when it seemed too quotidian or too raw and new. And our job, as an artist, one's job is to look around and say, what is there in, I don't know what, the housing development, the airport, wherever, where is the soul here? And sometimes it's most where the soul seems to be absent, that it's crying to be recognized and needs to be seen afresh.
So then it is in the seeing, and the charge is to open and see.
Yeah, and seeing is a figure of speech. It's listening and smelling. You know, it's in the seeing for a visual artist. I assume that for a musician, hearing is the main part of making music. And for a poet, it's just about everything at once, you know. It's understanding and seeing and musing about the history of and thinking about the sociology of and listening to the jokes told by and just every single aspect of experience. The way 3 teenage boys talk on the back of the bus, somewhere in there is something. And among other things, there's history. If one of them says to another one, was that your brother I saw the other night at the library? It's in this particular language, and somewhere in those words, brother and library and the ordinariness of it and the blue vinyl seats of the bus, there's something worth noticing.
Mm-hmm.
That's my working idea anyway.
His attitude about brother, library,
yes.
And what you do on an evening.
Yeah, those are all rich things, and those are things that people in communities do. And he's partly just saying to the other guy, I know you. You know me, don't you? Which a lot of our talk is, basically. It's like the soldiers in the rampart at the beginning of Hamlet. Is that you? Are you there? And all the variations of that process of asking one another, are you here with me? those variations are worth recording and listening to and trying to see the beauty in or the ugliness in or whatever is worth having feelings about.
We're talking to Robert Pinsky, if you've just tuned in. He's a teacher currently at Boston University, a poet, author of 4 books of poetry, and a critic, author of 2 of criticism. What Is this a question you can answer? What or who is the muse to you?
The muse to me is a calm or attentiveness that settles on me in relation maybe even to an agitated emotion or just to a scene. That calm, or I think we make the muse feminine not only for sexual reasons, because art is a kind of arousal and so many artists have been men historically, but also for a man or woman, the muse is maternal. So that we can say that for a woman artist also, there is a muse that is female. The muse comes and says, I will take care of you. And the way that she does that is she says, you now are feeling a melancholy or a desperation or an anger that I can help you make into something beautiful. And for me, I can remember as a kid, I hated school. When it gets to be about 4:30, 5 o'clock, and it starts to get too dark to do anything outside, and kind of yellow lights come on in kitchen windows, and there really aren't that many hours left before you have to go to bed. A sense of how beautiful the possibilities of life are. You might meet somebody new. You might have a romantic experience. You might discover a beautiful landscape or room you haven't seen yet. You're acutely aware of them and they're dwindling. And if I'm not lucky or not good that day, I just feel that and then it passes. And I say, I'm supposed to stop at the store. What do you want me to pick up? Or something.
Yeah.
And if I am lucky or good, then that day the muse comes and says, try this rhythm with it. You know, or here are some words for it, or here's a part of it you didn't notice before.
You brought up in a lecture that you gave Maya Antonia and a character in it who said that the land in which he lived, the land in which he lived was insignificant, and he would like to bring the muse to it. And what you said in response to that was, you don't bring the muse to the land to inspire it.
Mm-hmm. You don't make the land better. You yeah. introduce the muse to another thing the muse can see. It's to the mutual benefit of the muse and the place. I think Maya Antonia is a very profound book and very much a book about America as a place that is, you know, she is from Nebraska, so it's the plains. But the plains become a metaphor for the emptiness or potential of the country, not used up quality of the country, which is both lonely and inspiring, needs things brought to it, you know, Christmas ornaments from Sweden, mushrooms from Bavaria, music from Italy, and a source of a way to renew those things. And Jim Burton, her character, reads when he goes to university about Virgil saying he would like to be the first to introduce the muse to his little region. And Jim Burton, who winds up as a railroad lawyer, in what I think Cather is conveying is a diminution or a loss of his ambition in relation to the muse. The railroad is another way to conquer the space, but perhaps by going through it or out of it. Jim Burton conceives the ambition to not to glorify the place or make the place better than it was by introducing the muse to it, but by saying to the muse, there's this too. Mm-hmm. This too is real. This too is here.
I wonder, I'm thinking about the parable in the Bible of the talents, where the merchant gives each of three employees or...
Children, I think.
Children too.
Or is it servants? Maybe it is servants. Anyway, yeah. And if you just bury it in the field, it's not as good as if you do something with it.
Right.
In the Lord's eyes. And doing something with it is art, and really shades off right down to get back to my imaginary kids on the bus. Making conversation is making. You know, making something of yourself or making your house look nice. You know, making yourself up when you get up in the morning. You don't really have to chat on the bus, but everybody feels better if you do. Companionable silence, and then you say something. And art is like that, you know, it fills up the space and makes things a little prettier or more interesting.
But there's also something about just living in that, that you raised the example of that we are a making species, that we make things.
It seems the main thing about human beings to me is that they just are not content with what was already there. They always want to pile one stone on top of another.
Right.
Or hum to themselves, you know.
Press the shirt before you go out the door.
Something. You do some little thing.
Yeah.
And it has its destructive side, too. You know, we won't leave things alone. We break things. We wreck stuff. We hurt one another. We invent weapons. One way or another, we want to tear things up and make them differently. I can remember talking about this idea to a friend of mine and saying how we invent horrors, we invent torture, we invent the same ingenuity. It makes you wonder if our ingenuity is worth it, the same ingenuity that comes up with musical instruments and beautiful cloth and art also comes up with nuclear weapons and prisons and torture chambers. While I was talking to her, I looked down and we were outside. I'd torn up a blade of grass and I was playing just, you know, bending and twisting the blade of grass while I was talking about it.
He's making and destroying.
It's breaking up the landscape.
Right. Let me stop and reintroduce you to people with some specifics. Among this gentleman's books of criticism, The Situation of Poetry was published in 1977 by Princeton University Press. And by Echo Press in 1988, Poetry and the World, those two books of criticism. He has been a professor most recently at Boston University. Before that, at University of California, Berkeley, from 1980 to 89, a professor of English. He has taught as a visiting lecturer at Harvard and as a professor at Wellesley and at University of Chicago. A long career of teaching since 1966. You, Robert Pinsky, you have a strong interest, it seems to me, in looking at your works in the history of things, where stuff comes from, whether
yes.
it is the nose on your face or the wool in the sweater that you're mm-hmm. wearing. Where does that come from?
I come from a place with an interesting past, so if I speculate about where this habit of mind comes from, I think about my town. I'm not a scholarly person in the sense that I don't assimilate a lot of precise historical information, but I am a kind of a jackdaw or a pack rat. I do love bits of lore and information. And my town had a lot of history. It used to be very glorious. Long Branch, New Jersey is the town that the saloon in Gunsmoke is named for. Old timers will refer to crinkle cuts as Long Branch potatoes. It was the summer capital of Garfield and Grant. We had the Garfield Grant Hotel downtown. Diamond Jim Brady and Lillian Russell used to ride an electric car up and down the promenade where Grant drove fast horses in the previous decade. And even Woodrow Wilson had a summer capital in Long Branch. So we had big estates and a lot of interesting history. There's a beautiful Winslow Homer called Long Branch, New Jersey. Homer was commissioned by Harper's to do drawings of the fashionable people at Long Branch. Paris designers would send representatives there to see what the women were wearing and might want to wear the next season. And when I was a kid, it was just a kind of funky ethnic resort town in which one of the slogans, the things you always heard, is the town isn't what it used to be. Erosion, literal erosion of the beach was a big concern when I was a kid. Councilor City Commissioner Armin Tamini had the Army engineers shooting sand off the beach out into the ocean to try to make a reef, and people would laugh. The sand would wind up, pretty much on Normandy or Ireland or somewhere. So it may be that a kind of yarn spinning, lore trading. There used to be a cornfield there, but the hurricane came by and now it's ocean, and kind of. Tall tale quality that I got through a few generations in the town, where my grandpa did have a prominent bar called the Broadway Tavern, that maybe this idea of something coming before comes from knowing that I went to the same high school as my mom and dad and my aunts and uncles. So one answer to the question of where that frame of mind comes from might be that I grew up thinking about where things came from, or what was there before.
Will you read for us? There's a poem called Shirt, where you look, it's not quite an historical poem, and yet it is, but you look very closely at what's around you, it seems to me, and this poem is something that looks very closely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Shirt. The back, the yoke, the yardage, lapped seams. The nearly invisible stitches along the collar turned in a sweatshop by Koreans or Malaysians gossiping over tea and noodles on their break or talking money or politics while one fitted this arm piece with its overseam to the band of cuff I button at my wrist. The presser, the cutter, the wringer, the mangle, the needle, the union, the treadle, the bobbin, the code, the infamous blaze at the Triangle Factory in 1911. 146 died in the flames on the ninth floor. No hydrants, no fire escapes. The witness in a building across the street who watched how a young man helped a girl to step up to the windowsill, then held her out away from the masonry wall and let her drop. And then another. As if he were helping them up to enter a streetcar, and not eternity. A third, before he dropped her, put her arms around his neck and kissed him. Then he held her into space and dropped her. Almost at once he stepped to the sill himself. His jacket flared and fluttered up from his shirt as he came down, air filling up the legs of his gray trousers. Like Hart Crane's bedlamite, shrill shirt ballooning. Wonderful how the pattern matches perfectly across the placket and over the twin bar-tacked corners of both pockets, like a strict rhyme or a major chord. Prints, plaids, checks, houndstooth, Tattersall, Madras. The clan tartans invented by mill owners inspired by the hoax of Ossian to control their savage Scottish workers, tamed by a fabricated heraldry, MacGregor, Bailey, McMartin. The kilt devised for workers to wear among the dusty clattering looms, weavers, carders, spinners, the loader, the docker, the navvy. The planter, the picker, the sorter sweating at her machine in a litter of cotton as slaves in calico head rags sweated in fields. George Herbert, your descendant is a black lady in South Carolina. Her name is Irma, and she inspected my shirt. Its color and fit and feel and its clean smell have satisfied both her and me. We have culled its cost and quality down to the buttons of simulated bone, the buttonholes, the sizing, the facing, the characters printed in black on neckband and tail, the shape, the label, the labor, the color, the shade, the shirt.
Shirt is from The Want Bone, Robert Pinsky's most recent book of poetry published in 1990 by Echo Press. This is a poem about something that is ordinary, banal. We, billions of us, put one on every day before we go out the door. And yet you find horror in it in some ways.
A lot of suffering and deprivation and sweat and ingenuity go into it. The reason it's the shape it is and the way its seams are made the way they are, people had to figure out and devise and think about. And even the fibers are the product of a lot of work and dirt and sweat. And, it's like our language that we speak. You know, I learned this language because my ancestors went through a lot of trouble to arrive at the place where they speak it. And the names of these patterns, Tattersall, Madras, also have stories behind them. I love the fact that the kilt, which when I was a kid, snob men's stores would have little charts where if your name was McGregor or Campbell or whatever, you could go and see what supposedly your ancestors wore when they were heroic Highlands warriors. Oh, it's baloney. It was invented in the Industrial Revolution, the 19th century. They had these very, very rough, uneducated workers. And they invented the kilt from the wear in factories. And there was no particular correlation between any clan and any particular tartan or pattern. A clever manufacturer figured it out and did it as a promotional thing.
And the hunting tartans and the dress tartans that people hold with such pride are...
Yeah, it's a lot of baloney. It means more in towns like Princeton, New Jersey, and Shaker Heights, Ohio, than it would ever mean in Scotland.
What about this fire? Did he really help them out into eternity?
The famous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, in which so many people, mostly women, mostly, though not all, and mostly... Italian and Jewish immigrants die, was a key moment, as I get it, in the history of the American labor movement. This is based on a newspaper story about this man holding these women away from the building so they could jump to their death rather than be burned to death, and then jumping himself wasn't a newspaper story. Interestingly, it's a kind of a dream. No one has quite been able to authenticate it. That is, it was in a contemporary newspaper account, but no research has been able to find the author of the newspaper story or to locate who those people might have been. So it's in a gray area. It's conceivable that it's what's called an urban myth.
Folklore.
It's also conceivable that it happened exactly like this. Uh-huh. And. It's very congruent with the theme of making and making up and equivalent truths and the kind of painful process of creation that my poem is about, that this nightmare for these people and the sweetness of what they do, you know, her embracing him and kissing before he drops her and then he goes himself, that is in an area where we don't know exactly in what sense it's true, which I think is true about most of the things we get from the past. Famous dialogue between the rabbi and the skeptical young man, where the young man says, "Rabbi, I don't want to believe anything we get from tradition. I want to discover everything for myself. Why should we follow tradition? I want to learn it all myself." And the rabbi draws the letter Aleph on a page. It's the first letter of the alphabet, and says, "What's that?" And the young man says, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "What is it?" It's an Aleph. The rabbi says, "How do you know?" So, really, we have almost everything. You know, no one is alive who really was at the Battle of Lepanto or saw the Civil War. But we believe what we read and what we find archaeologically. You know, everything is on evidence from the past.
You know, speaking about Rabbi, I want to create it all myself. You said in this same lecture I referred to earlier that. We are makers and destroyers, and that although we get who we are, we learn who we are from our neighborhoods and our region and our parents and our religion and our schools, that we have the opportunity to constantly remake ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then you said a remarkable thing. I am a man and a Jew, but if I cannot be at least somewhat a woman and Japanese, then what's the point?
Yeah.
I want to know more about that, and from a writer's perspective, but also from a human's perspective, since those who are listening will be made up of more of the genus human than they will of the genus writers.
Sure. When I said, what's the point? I mean, what's the point of all this talking and reading books and looking at pictures and striving if I am doomed to be defined by the givens, the things that were determined at my birth? Obviously, I can never, you're younger than me, you're a woman, I can never be your generation, I'll always be mine, and even if I took the most advanced surgery, I could never be a woman in the sense that you are. But if I talk to you, and I've spoken to other women and other people younger than me, I hope the result is, since I'm a consciousness too, not just a body and a history, I hope that that consciousness becomes a little bit more, slightly more, the consciousness of a woman and the consciousness of somebody 10 years younger than me. Same if I, you know, I'll never be a black jazz musician, but if I study the art and I talk to a black person and read enough and listen enough, I'll be more like that than I was before. And that's the point of paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I hope it'll make me a little bit more free, too, that I won't be defined. I will do some act of self-definition.
That's what I was just thinking. And Robert Pinsky will be more the man who is Robert Pinsky and more the Jew and more the other descriptors that you are by this empathy or this learning.
Yeah, since sooner or later I'll die, I might as well, as much as I can, be the most, be more. And this is a corrective to, it's a corrective to many emotions that are perhaps have their good side too, like various chauvinisms, nationalism, all sorts of parochialisms. It's a very classic, old-fashioned, humanistic corrective, saying, yeah, I am this and this and this, but I'm also a human being. Uh-huh. And if you expect me to have the traits of somebody of my age, social class, ethnic background, religious training, and so forth, it's part of my privilege as a human being to astonish you. And though I'm a black woman, I'm also a highbrow classical musician or a musicologist. And you know, and I'm a Chinese quarterback or whatever. You know, I defy some of your expectations.
There is a poem you wrote called An Old Man that which seems to me about the reverse of that, about limits.
Yes. It's an interesting, it's a poem. I'm never sure whether to call it a translation, because it's based on the Greek poem of Constantine Cavafy, I hope fairly close to it, but I don't read Greek. And I call it after Cavafy, An Old Man After Cavafy. Back in a corner, alone in the clatter and babble, an old man sits with his head bent over a table and his newspaper in front of him in the cafe. Sour with old age, he ponders a dreary truth. How little he enjoyed the years when he had youth, good looks and strength and clever things to say. He knows he's quite old now. He feels it. He sees it. And yet the time when he was young seems, was it, yesterday. How quickly it slipped away. Now he sees how discretion has betrayed him, and how stupidly he let the liar persuade him with phrases. Tomorrow, there's plenty of time. Someday. He recalls the pull of impulses he suppressed, the joy he sacrificed. Every chance he lost ridicules his brainless prudence a different way. But all these thoughts and memories have made the old man dizzy. He falls asleep, his head resting on the table in the noisy cafe. Well, Susan, I understand what you mean by saying this is the opposite. It has to do with limitation. Mm. On the other hand, that is, this is the opposite of the process of being something other than what you are. On the other hand, this is a very early Cavafy poem. It is the poem of a young man, and I think we can, if we think about it, we can tell it's the poem of a young man. It's a young man's idea of age. Cavafy was homosexual, and at the time he wrote the poem, was doubtless terrified by the idea of being in the closet, and he looked at an old man, I would imagine, or imagined an old man, and thought, how terrible to become that. And through an act of empathy, that is, he was a young man who imagined being an old man, and that is very much what I'm talking about. He found a way to express his anxieties through imagining himself in someone else's body. And I'm not homosexual. I'm neither a particularly young or old man. I translate his poem or do a version of his poem because for me, those anxieties and the fear of confining yourself, missing something, and a sense of mortality is epitomized in the poems, brought to the poems. And there's the triple act. And if somebody, God knows, if somebody hears me read the poem or reads my poem, then it becomes a quadruple and a more and more complex act of finding more in yourself by imagining along with someone else.
In this poem, you also do something that I didn't see in many other poems, and perhaps because it is after Gavafi, that makes sense. This is a rhyming poem.
Yeah.
Does using, if we can talk for a moment about form, does employing rhyme allow you to do something that other forms might not, or I don't know.
Form contains some things and can't contain others, so that rhyme gives you some things you can do and then some things you can't do.
What happens here with rhyme that you might not do otherwise?
This poem returns, it has six stanzas, six times we start over again, and each time it winds up with a word that goes a, cafe, say, away, day, way, and then at the end, cafe again, which Gavafi doesn't do, but I do come back to cafe again. And on the other hand, the sentences swell across the other lines. Usually we press past every chance. He lost ridicules, you know, lost, suppressed, but lost. And Babel, an old man said, I've been over a table, blah, blah, blah. So there's a stretching of past limits and always at the end returning to a limit that seems to work out. As a reader now, I see that work out as a pretty possible way to convey this emotion, this feeling. I never feel that I'm writing without a form. Shirt poem doesn't rhyme, but it's in pretty strict iambic pentameter, blank verse, and which traditionally in English is a rather more less song-like and rather more noble form than rhyme. You know, it's the form of Shakespeare's plays and most sonnets in English and so forth. But in a free verse poem, you're using another form and you can do the things that's in that one, you know, so-called free verse. This poem, Gavafi was making something that was like a song, that is reproduced the same tune over and over again with different words for each verse. And it's the song of fear of dying without doing everything you should have done because you were timid. And that's an interesting thing to sing about. If the shirt is a song, it's a song of all the history behind one object, and it seems to be a song with a more muted tune.
Can you, I want to change directions on you for a minute if I can. Can you talk to me about the way you read? It is at once so precise and at the same time doesn't detract from the reading, and it's very interesting to me. Is it schooled?
It is certainly studied. I didn't go to school to learn how to do it, but there's probably no subject in the world that I've thought about more than what a poem is in its bodily being. I mean, poetry is a very, it's not only a physical art, it is a bodily art. The instrument is one human body. The instrument of a poem is one voice saying words in a certain order, and it comes out of this moist column of air inside me, and the vibrations I make in my throat, in my voice box, and then with my mouth, this moist, dark chamber of my mouth, and then it vibrates, tiny bones and membranes in somebody's ear vibrates. In a way, it is more bodily than dancing, because it is constantly converting what is not of the body, that is thoughts and ideas, into a very intimate, inner, it's in the inside of the body, a very inner bodily process. And for me, it's a crucial aspect of poetry, is that physical aspect. So when I approach a poem and want to hear it aloud, I want to be careful to hear the ways that it's different from every other poem. To some extent, I can only do that by honoring its sounds. So I mustn't be too expressive. I mustn't be too interpretive. If I say, back in a corner, alone, in the clatter and babble, and all, or some other histrionic interpretation, the bodily sounds of the poem are being obscured by my interpretation of it. On the other hand, if I read it as if it has no meaning, but only read it for its physical pattern, back in a corner, alone in the clatter and babble, an old man sits with his head bent over a table, I'm also losing something. Somewhere in between the two is the poem. Back in a corner, alone in the clatter and babble, an old man sits with his head bent over a table and his newspaper in front of him in the cafe. And thinking about those two fallacies, which in a way is to read only the rhythm on the one hand, or to read only one's idea of what is being expressed on the other hand, someplace between the two is that dance between the ideas and the body that is poetry.
And in some ways, because the creating of poetry is an abstract from a concrete, mm-hmm. then that's, it's kind of a balance on a balance,
yes,
isn't it?
The pattern is there, and the pattern is enacted by the specific human body. The ideas are there, and the ideas are acted in very specific physical rhythms.
Do you read out loud as you write?
Yes, I always try things out loud. You know, I'll write silently for a new phrase, but then I'll mutter it to myself. And oh man, it's just a love. You know, I need to mumble to myself because otherwise, it's you're not playing your instrument.
And all the way through, you check to see if
oh,
the
yeah.
one line relates to the last line orally as well as it does.
Sure, in a way, almost before. Often you're composing, you'll hear a syntactical pattern that will charm you before you quite know even almost what words are in it. You know, you'll think it would be nice to write a list that was da-da, 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 da-da. You know, and you'll hear, there are times, Frost has a poem that begins, all out of doors gaze darkly in at him through the thin frost, almost in separate stars that gathers on the pane in empty rooms. And I can almost picture him thinking, you know, you'll hear the syntax that you want and the rhythm that you want almost and sometimes literally before you hear the meaning.
And does that get better as you become a more experienced and practiced poet?
I hope so. I hope so. I don't know. In some ways, writing gets harder as I get older, I find. But I hope to God that also there's some things you get a little better at. Since it gets harder, I hope it gets better in some way, too.
And why do you think it gets harder?
Well, you know, for the beginning of a writing career for many people, you have your obsessions. You have the things that have impelled you to where you are. You have your autobiography. You have your family. You have certain things that you feel you'll just die if you don't get out. And at some point, long after your first or second book, you realize you have, as best as you can, done that. And then you look around and you say, I am an artist, I am a writer. What do I have that I'm good at? What is in the world that demands writing about? What can I do? And you have to ask that question that wasn't even a question when you were younger. And full of that first explosion.
Mm-hmm. You, in your own words from the other night, you open that aperture even
yes.
wider.
Yes, you yeah. try to say, if I am a window or have been born with a window to look at before I cash in, you know, I've seen the first thing you see when you look straight out the window. Can I move at an angle and see a little more? Can I maybe stretch the window a bit? What's next? What more? And aside from all the other things you don't want to do, you now don't want to imitate yourself, too. Before, that wasn't a problem because you didn't exist. And once you exist, you have to also say, well, I don't want to imitate Robert.
Right.
Aside from all the other people you don't want to imitate.
Right. Forget Milton.
Yeah.
I'm starting to imitate myself. This is Robert Pinsky, a poet, a critic, and a teacher. You tell stories, too, in your poetry? Do you see... Do the stories emerge as you write, or do you... I guess the one of the poems I'm thinking of is the title poem for this book, The Want Bone.
Yes.
Which I'd love to hear you read. Mm-hmm. Also, it is essentially about the jaw of a shark, but it is so many more things, and you tell stories about it. Perhaps you'd read it and then talk to me about storytelling in your life.
You don't happen to know what page it's on in this noble book, The Want Bone, do you,
Susan?
In this
noble book. It is on page 14.
Good. Thank you. The Want Bone. The tongue of the waves toiled in the earth's bell, blue rippled and soaked in the fire of blue. The dried mouth bones of a shark in the hot swale gaped on nothing but sand on either side. The bone tasted of nothing and smelled of nothing, a scalded, toothless harp, uncrushed, unstrung. The joined arcs made the shape of birth and craving, and the welded open shape kept mouthing, oh. Ossified cords held the corners together in groined spirals, pleated like a summer dress. But where was the limber grin, the gash of pleasure? Infinitesimal mouths bore it away. The beach scrubbed and etched and pickled it clean. But oh, I love you, it sings. My little, my country, my food, my parent, my child, I want you, my own, my flower, my fin, my life, my lightness, my oh. Well, what is it? I guess it's your straight ahead love poem. At its most devouring and desirous, you know, this thing, this shark has been dead a good long time, and its mouth, if you haven't seen one of these things, the mouth is frozen. It's a very beautiful object, and terrifying not because it looks like it's going to bite you, because it's frozen in that gesture that we all have way inside us of, I want, I want your love. Mm-hmm. You know, that big wide O of wanting to be filled and comforted. And it seemed, I guess you were right that it's a story, because I can remember being impressed by the object, returning to the East Coast seashore where I grew up, to that landscape, having just seen this object, and probably the germination of the poem was with the historical, was with the past tense. As soon as I said the tongue of the waves tolled in the earth's bell, then it's a series of things that happen. And the series of things are this thing being dried, being nothing, tasting of nothing, smelling of nothing, and persisting in saying, oh, I want. And sometimes you look around at the world and you'll see very dignified experts or politicians on the TV, or the very matter-of-fact, casual, confident guy who comes to build the back porch or install the refrigerator, or the doctor who shines his light in your ear, and you marvel to yourself, yes, every one of these people, the woman who brought me my turkey sandwich, every one of these people, in them somewhere, has that thing that says, I love, I want my mother or my daughter or my lover. And none of us are dignified in there. We all simply are like a person who's very turned on sexually, or like a child that's very, very needy of its parent, or a parent that very much wants to cradle the child. And it's in there all the time, and you can't kill it. You know, it just is very gorgeously and terrifyingly persistent and suppressible but not deniable. In a way, this is the other side of the old man in the Cavafy poem. And
the part of the old man that Cavafy may have been too young to see.
Yeah.
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 It's always there. Did you... this is a curiosity. Did you laugh to yourself at the muse that told you that the dried up skeleton of of a shark's mouth was a want bone, an embodied. Yeah.
Sure, sure. I laugh at my own title quite often because it sounds so much like some sexual joke.
Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, it sounds phallic. Fortunately, the want bone, if anything, is more like a female part than a male part. But yeah, I mean, your question is right to the heart of what art is for me. I mean, I laugh at almost everything that seems a good idea to me. And I can well imagine Shakespeare slapping his thigh and chuckling when he realizes that he's going to have Lear bring in the strangled body of Cordelia and break everybody's heart, including his own.
Right.
That there's some other point at which you go, ha, 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 he can bring her in on stage. You know, he can carry the actor in.
Right.
And say, howl, 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 howl. And Shakespeare perhaps would laugh to himself when he realized he was writing the line, howl, 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 howl. Sure. And not that he was cynical about it. He knew it was agony, but there's also that laugh of pleasure that you've done something audacious mm-hmm. or unexpected.
And this brings me to a curiosity I had also about you. I noticed the other night what I thought was a child's pleasure in play with the words and concepts that come to you, that delight at the muse, Shakespeare slapping his knee. And at the same time, it's a deadly serious, fully adult intellectual game.
Yes. Yeah. I feel that way all the time. Or try to. You know, I hope I feel that way. Well, I think I do, in fact, in relation to this thing, this poetry and words. There's a part of me that always is amazed at a kind of compulsion I probably had when I was barely articulate and just learning language, kind of gurgling delight in these grunts and vibrations we make with our mouths, that they have meanings and shades of meaning. And though it has become my profession and my adult obsession and seems very tied to what it means to be a human being for me, there also is some level at which it's like playing Nintendo or, you know, hitting a tennis ball or uh-huh. some other not particularly demanding intellectual. It's a pleasure. It's like, you know, going down a ski slope real fast. It's just fun.
What I want your thoughts on language. You said the other night that you are not of the school that believes this language is going to hell in a handbasket because of the way people mutate it. But perhaps it is the lack of mutation that may be the death of us. And I think I'm misphrasing or making up my own words.
Well,
to say
I do. I am very skeptical of the people who say nobody speaks English properly anymore or nobody mm-hmm. writes English properly anymore. I think that's easy to say and expresses cultural anxieties that may have good motivations. The culture may be going in directions that this person who says that doesn't like. But the language is very rubbery and strong, and this language of ours in particular has never been codified. There's no central authority. There's no papal or French Academy authority that gives us rules. And the genius of the language has always been its fluidity and its mixing. I personally am very, very different from the poet I name in the shirt poem, George Herbert, you know, who was an upper-class, fanatically devout Anglican of one of the great families of England in the 17th century. I would imagine that the people who are going to be writing poems in this language, if there are people writing poems in this language 200 years from now, are going to be even more different from me mm-hmm. than I am from George Herbert. Why shouldn't their language be somewhat different too, just as my language is both the same as Herbert's and different? I think things that kids invent can be quite eloquent and betray a lot of mastery of language. And speakers of English, we have such a big vocabulary compared to most languages, much bigger vocabulary than French or Italian or German. And our crazy idioms and the things we do with word order and context because we don't have case endings. Can you put me up? Can you put up with me? Don't bring me down. You put me down. Go down on me. Come on down. Come on up. Are you, that's way up in the, someone who wasn't a native speaker would have a lot of trouble with all those.
Right.
6-year-old doesn't have trouble with them.
Although a friend of mine has said about just those kinds of up, down, back, forth, that it makes us highly schizophrenic. It's just, get it up, get down, get
up,
get down.
Yeah. It's a peculiar language, and its peculiarity and its genius have to do with it being made up of many, many groups who come at it from many directions, and it was changing a lot more in the 16th and 17th century before it was ossified by print and movies. It's changing more slowly now, and I have lots of confidence both in the language and in the, the new immigrants, the Anglophone African writers, all of that. Why shouldn't we believe that the human genius is doing something good to this artifact? It's the English language. Why believe it's doing something bad to it because kids don't punctuate well in some middle-class high school?
Do you, when you look at language in this culture, do you see categories of greatest growth and freedom and categories of greatest ossification?
I'm not an expert in that, Yeah. I push these sounds around in the poems that I make myself, and I don't know if I'm a great cultural critic. I know that in almost every area of life, I hear language that sounds dead to me. You know, books of poems, out on the street, kids playing, and examples of language that seem very inventive and charming or penetrating, again, in books of poems, kids playing on the street, repair guy in the hardware store. And this is more like we all do it, and you see people who walk gracefully, and you see people who have clunky walks, and there are people who are brilliant conversationalists in every idiom. There'll be winos talking on the street, and one of them is a wino, has a certain great patter. He's good at it. And the others may be kind of slow. And if you go to a lot of English professors, there's one of them has an amusie. The others like to listen. And there's one, he opens up his mouth, everybody starts to doze off. And I think it's the same in the third grade.
I wonder if you'll read for us again. I liked The Night Game.
Okay.
About baseball. I think I have a page here. 55. Once again, we've been reading, hello, Robert Pinsky has been reading from his latest book of poetry, The Want Bone, published by Echo Press in 1990. And this is The Night Game.
Yeah. Maybe I will say one sentence about it.
Good.
The poem starts off with an idea that's often occurred to me, is how much you would have invented on your own of things like, all the songs on the radio, half of them are about their love songs. Would you have invented, every culture doesn't have romantic love. It was invented in European courts in the, 15th or 14th century? I don't know. It's an idea. Would you have invented it yourself, or do you get your idea of it from the culture, and are you dependent on it? And arts, could you have made up poetry if there wasn't poetry already? And if you were born and you had never heard anyone sing or make music, could you have made up music? It's the kind of bright 14-year-old's philosophy that I can remember thinking from quite young. Uh-huh. The Night Game. Some of us believe we would have conceived romantic love out of our own passions, with no precedents, without songs and poetry. Or have invented poetry and music as a comb of cells for the honey. Shaped by ignorance, a succession of new worlds, congruities improvised by immigrants or children. I once thought most people were Italian, Jewish, or colored. To be white and called something like Ed Ford seemed aristocratic. A rare distinction. Possibly I believed only Gentiles and blondes could be left-handed. Already famous after 1 year in the majors, Whitey Ford was drafted by the Army to play ball in the flannels of the Signal Corps, stationed in Long Branch, New Jersey. A night game, the silver potion of the lights, his pink skin shining like a burn. Never a player I liked or hated, a Yankee, a mere success. But white the chalked off lines in the grass, white and green the immaculate uniform, and white the unpigmented halo of his hair when he shifted his cap. So ordinary and distinct, so close up, that I felt as if I could have made him up, imagined him as I imagined the ball, a scintilla high in the black backdrop of the sky. Tight red stitches, rawlings, the bleached horsehide white, the color of nothing, color of the past and of the future, of the movie screen at rest and of blank paper. I could have. The mind, the black backdrop, the white fly picked out by the towering lights. A few years later, on a blanket in the grass by that same river, a girl and I came into being together to the faint muttering of unthinkable troubadours and radios. The Emerald Theater, the night. Another time, I devised a left-hander even more gifted than Whitey Ford, a Dodger. People were amazed by him. Once, when he was young, he refused to pitch on Yom Kippur.
The Night Game by Robert Pinsky from his book, The Want Bone. In the moments we have left, I suppose I want to ask you, what are you working on? What are you enjoying these days?
Well, this book did come out pretty recently, so I am again engaged in that little activity we talked about of looking around and seeing what is left to write about. I am an anecdotal person, and these poems, as you can see, have flashes of story and fragments of story in them. I think that as I look at the writing I've been doing since then, it has tended to divide the impulses of singing and story, so that I'm writing some prose narrative of a more straight-ahead, the man came into the room and looked around way than I've done before. I used to feel I couldn't write the sentence, the man came into the room, in prose, because there's no man, there's no room, it's me talking. In a poem I can say anything. Can't say the man came into the room, and somehow I've gotten old enough to feel now I am writing that the man came into the room, and as somebody says, the countess went out at 4:30. I can write it. And the poems, on the other hand, that I've been writing have become more in a single moment, maybe less narrative, and more, you know, there's one called Falling Asleep, and it's really just about that moment of falling asleep. And the one House Hour that I read last night is just about that time of day when I look around at a certain kind of lower middle class immigrant neighborhood and I get just slightly weepy because I know it so well, and I know that time of day and that time of the winter so well. So I may have exaggerated the role of the will too much in deciding what you're going to write next. Right now I seem to be writing songs that are more purely in a moment, staying in a moment, and prose stories more like the anecdotes and jokes I like to tell with my friends.
Hey. Robert Pinsky, thank you for joining us on Conversations.
It's a great pleasure, Susan.
For those who'd like to follow this man to his words, his first book, Landor's Poetry, University of Chicago Press, was published as early as 1968. Sadness and Happiness, this is your first book of poetry, was published in 1975 by Princeton University Press. Sadness and Happiness was chosen for the Princeton Series of Contemporary Poets in the first year of that competition. The second book of poetry, An Explanation of America, took the Saxifrage Prize. It was published by Princeton University Press in 1980. History of My Heart, in 1984 by Echo Press, took the William Carlos Williams Award, and The Want Bone too young to be awarded?
Yeah, I guess
perhaps.
So.
Yeah. Just came out in 1990 by Echo Press. Two books of criticism, Poetry and the World, is the most recent, published in 1988 by Echo Press, and earlier, The Situation of Poetry, called a most influential work of criticism, was published by Princeton University in 1977. Robert Pinsky, a pleasure to have you with us on Conversations.
Thank you.
Thank you. And those of you listening, I hope you'll join me again next week.
Just the person. In fact, he spoke to me. I said, can I have your autograph, Whitey? He said, not now, kid.
And you've never forgotten.
Yeah, I don't hold it against
him. And he never remembered.
That's right.
Sure. Very important moment in your life.
But also, I'd never seen a night game before. And it was both night and day. The things that I could see that the sky was black, but there was this silver potion on everything. Mm-hmm. And it was a new reality. It was like life became a work of art. He was a famous person. Yeah. He was the blondest person I'd ever seen in my life. I lived in a town mostly of Italians, and I lived in a partly black neighborhood. So I saw Jews, Italians, and black people most of the time.
That's what you mean by you thought
yeah.
the world was.
Yeah. And here was the world's blondest man, famous, an expert, and the world had been transformed. It was a mixture of night and day. And I imagined it. That is, it was real, but my imagination was making it for me mm-hmm. as I saw it. And though I didn't care much about Whitey Ford per se, I was seeing a new reality.
Mm-hmm.
I was seeing something new.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant I was making it. You know, I was beholding it. It was there, but not everybody there that night saw that thing.
Yeah.
I saw it.
They went to the baseball game. You went
yeah.
to magic somehow.
I saw that magic.
Yeah.
And which means that I must have made it. And it means, in a sense, I made him.
Right.
And what you feel about, you are partly making. If you have emotion about it, it's not just what it was. You're making it.
Right.
Famous people in particular are made by other people.
It's not just two people standing on the corner. It's
yeah.
love or it's fury
yeah,
or it's...
that's right. And yeah. that thing is a creation.
Got it.
You're mad at a person, you're making them. He wasn't who you were mad at before you were mad at him.
Right.
And if you fall in love with somebody, you're always, it's famous that you're making them up. Everybody knows that. And Lolita Nabokov talks about the gorilla they tried to teach to make Artie Drew's cage. yeah.
Sure.
You're making that person who's going to dominate your thinking. And sure, I mean, some people say, why can't you name Sandy Koufax at the end? Isn't it coy? But the question is, if Sandy Koufax didn't exist, as if poetry didn't exist, would I have been capable of making him up? I think in a way, yeah. It was a wonderful example of something that happened to happen in reality that also was a thing that I was very ready to imagine was
the Jewish player who
gorgeously gifted Jewish player for the Dodgers, my team. Where the Yankees represented in their name and their pinstripe uniforms, they represented a kind of a conservative principle of success.
White bread America.
And the Dodgers had the first black player. They were from Brooklyn. They were nicknamed the Bums.
Right, tough, rough.
And they dodged.
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
They're originally the Trolley Dodgers. They're also very urban. And they were the ethnic team.
Trolley Dodgers is... running after jumping on the trolley.
Yeah, that's what they're called. Sure. Nicknamed originally, I think, some other thing. I can't remember. I used to know what the Dodgers were before they were the Trolley Dodgers.
Huh.
And then they became the Trolley. And now, of course, in L.A., nobody cares whether they're the Trolley Dodgers. Not exactly the home of public transportation.
Right. No.
And the idea of the left-handed being the other is part of it, too.
Right. Good poem.
Thanks.
Good poem, yes. Sorry, I'm making you up.
Yeah.
I like you. It's nice to
everybody,
listen. I like the way everybody, your brain works.
Everybody makes everybody up.
Yeah, that's for sure.
If I cut you off at a traffic line, or I take a parking space away from you,
I'll
you and
you
I get in
a fight.
Make
you up for a week and a half, right?
I'd be the same person.
Yeah.
You know, sometime in our history, there's been somebody exactly like you and somebody exactly like me.
Right.
And you say, what an asshole, took my parking space.
Sure.
But yeah. If you're...
flipped me off in the middle of the street.
Interviewing me because I wrote my poem. Yeah.
Right.
It's the same objective same reality, same person.
Right.
But
which
you
is
make
why,
me up as someone.
Which is why your lover, your wife, your husband is such an important person because you're constantly making them up.
Yeah.
The most beautiful girl in the world, the biggest asshole
yes.
I've
yeah,
ever
what
seen.
A, yes.
Right?
Tormentor, a
yeah.
demon. A
right.
demon. Or, you know,
sure.
an angel. And, of course, the truth is somewhere in between. Then you have to make that truth up, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And the truth isn't necessarily from the left-handed person's point of view, from the other's point of view, who doesn't know how horrible, wonderful, grand
they are.
Your image is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he thinks he's just having to do his army duty, and he doesn't know he's in a poem. Yeah. He's down in the Fort Monmouth, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Making an appearance.
Thanks. Nice hour.
Pleasure. I enjoyed myself.
Good.
You are good.
Thank you. Those are your cramps, so better not rob them away.
Yeah, he was actually a little concerned about that when you said I should bring my coffee.
Right. What do you
well,
do
what
with
about
mine?
My coffee? Yeah. He wants it.